Report is produced and broadcast by the Zeus Radio Network for Racers Reunion Radio. NASCAR takes on the high banks and Mother Nature all week long. The NHRA ran their last race before the U.S. Nationals, and the Madhouse Bowman Gray Stadium ended their season. All this and more. Welcome to Speedway Report for Monday, August 22nd. 2016, from the shores of Lake Norman in Race City, USA, Mooresville, North Carolina. I'm Patrick Reynolds, and thank you for joining us tonight. From the North Myrtle Beach ZRN Studios, producer Jeff Gilder is with us. I am reminded of the last time I played golf in Myrtle Beach. How bad did I play? I asked my caddy why he kept looking at his watch. He said, "That's not a watch, that's a compass." How are you, Daddy J?
I know that, caddy.
You play as well as I do.
It reminds me of a story, quick one, that back in Tennessee, I played with a friend of mine who was a member of the country club. I never was, you know, but he was. So he invited me down to his country club to play in, you know, private place. It's all stuffy and everything. I looked out of place, felt out of place. Mm-hmm. And we were playing with some people he knew, and man, I was hitting them off the tee everywhere, right, left. And he said, "Boy," he said, "next time I come play with you, I'm going to bring a dog to go find them balls." Oh, man, I lost a bunch of balls in the first nine. But anyway, and a bunch more on the back.
Did you map out a little bit of the woods and the terrain that surrounded the country club, get a good feel of the geography?
A little bit, and then I just stopped looking for him. That's when he's talked about the dog, you know, because I was leaving so many balls laying in the woods. I was embarrassed, man.
You know? You have days like that.
Yeah, absolutely.
I've been at the driving range, take a swipe at the ball, and I ricochet it off the barriers between me and the person standing next to me. And they're loud, too, so there's no escaping it. Yeah, we've all had our embarrassing golf stories, I'm sure.
Here, I just thought of another one. You asked for it.
Oh,
sorry.
Yeah. Go for it. Yeah, go.
First corporate tournament, company tournament I ever played in. I'd only been playing golf for a couple of years, and I really sucked. And our company had a big event, and we all lined up. Instead of having a shotgun start, they started us. They lined everybody up on the first tee, and I'm thinking, man, I'd hate to be the guy that's first, and then they call my name. and so I hear all these guys, you know, standing around talking, and the president of the company and all everybody's there, you know. And I'm up there nervous as can be, and they had bowling balls for the tee markers, okay, if you can imagine that. And the first one I hit, smack, hit one of those bowling balls. It went straight up in the air and came down in the crowd. They scattered. So, well, I got that out of the way, so, yeah.
Hey, somebody had to be first.
Yeah, I squibbed the next one up the fairway about 6 inches off the ground and grabbed my stuff and left. Yeah.
Are you sure you know how to play golf?
Well, I've gotten a little bit better since then, but not much.
I hope so. Yeah. Well, I've got good news for you regarding racing.
All right, what's that, brother?
Did you see our audience can't see this, but you can see me through the Skype camera on the top of my laptop. Yep. These panels that go behind me for Speedway Report Television, we have decals ready.
All right, cool.
Yeah, I am dropping the panels off tomorrow to get for those in the audience, this is work on the set for the TV show.
So that's sweet. It's going to look good, man. Yeah.
Panels will be dropped off tomorrow, and
more weight set in the shot.
Yeah. One of the nicknames for the studio could be the gym because shoulder. Yeah,
we've got the Speedway gym.
The barbell, the bench press, the plates, the pull-up rack. We got all that good stuff there, which fortunately the audience can't really see.
There's not a lot of weights on that barbell there. Is that all you press, man?
There is nothing on that barbell right now. There's no plates on that at all. I'm between sets, man.
I'm just kidding, man. I knew they couldn't see it. I thought I'd put you on the spot.
Yeah, well, I do rack my weights. I'm not one of those guys because for us in the gym, that's a real sore spot is people don't rack their weights. They kind of leave them strung along lazily, so I rack my weights. So it is, point be told, I'll give myself a little credit here so the audience knows as well. That's an Olympic bar, and a bare Olympic bar weighs 45 pounds on its own.
I'm going to learn about that tomorrow.
Are you?
It's probably going to be Wednesday, come to think of it.
What, are you going to Google it?
No.
No.
What
are you going to
I am starting my strength training regimen.
Fantastic.
My friend Ryan at the gym down two doors down here from me has been on to me and on to me and on to me. Yep. And he's going to start training me. And
outstanding.
We were actually supposed to start this morning. He forgot about it.
Isn't it awesome when your trainer provides the excuse for you not to work out? Nothing better.
Yeah.
That's a good Monday morning there.
Yep.
I actually haven't worked out or lifted in a few weeks. I'm kind of nursing a little tender back issue. So.
Oh, I've never in my life done strength training, but you know, I'm at the age now where I'm losing mass. I mean, it's all going to my gut. So we're going to work on that.
Well, the more muscle you have, the more that will help burn fat even when you're not working out.
That's what they say.
Muscle's good.
Yeah.
Muscle's good for you. Cool.
Yeah.
Well, if Speedway Report doesn't take off, we can get a fitness show going here. Maybe we'll start some health podcasts.
Yeah, there you go. We could do that.
You know, plan B, or in our case, plan probably H by now as we roll through this.
It's always good to have backups, though. You know, we just keep...
Yeah, just racers pull the car out of the hauler? Yeah, we got a backup plan.
We'll just keep fashioning those things up.
Oh, yeah. We'll keep throwing something out there at the audience until we get to go. So we'll try the cars. Want to go for some cars tonight?
Sure. Let's do it.
Fast cars turning left, going straight, and some of them turning right. Good evening, everyone. Thanks for tuning in. Jeff, I appreciate you bringing us to life. I appreciate our audience members tuning in tonight. Over on the chat rooms, everyone at racersreunion.com. I hop on over to the stock car site. Barley Phillips is there, along with Billy and Barbara Scott. Danny is with us, along with Jack Walker. Coastal in the house. Larry Urey and Jerry Smith still with us, the host of Stars Radio. And the drag racing site, Bill Pratt is in here early, getting ready for Racing and Rocking, coming up right after us, as well as Thomas Warren. Everybody, so good to see all of you here. If you'd like to join them, head on over to racersreunion.com. Log yourself in. Feel free to join the bench racing chat rooms. And hello to Leo down in South America, listening to us every week. Great audience member comes to us from south of the border, really south. Thanks for being with us, Leo. We welcome everyone to the show around the World Wide Web, wherever you are tuning in. Glad you are on board. Coming up tonight on Speedway Apart are your phone calls about anything in the world of racing. We will open up the phone lines a little bit later. We've got some information, some news, and a guest segment coming up. On the backside of that, I will let you know when the phone lines are open. And as a reminder, friendly reminder, like our Facebook page, Speedway Report with Patrick Reynolds, and follow me on Twitter. My handle is Speedway Pat. And coming up tonight as our special guest is Art Garner, the author of the book Black Noon, which tells the tale of the 1964 Indianapolis 500. A fascinating story. It's a final win for a front-engine roadster. The uprising of the rear engine car, the coming change in fuel, AJ Foyt's second win, and the tragic losses of Eddie Sachs and Dave McDonald. We've got author Art Garner coming up and joining us shortly. So I was at the season finale at the Bowman Gray Stadium. What track did you go to, and where are my troopers who toughed it out in Bristol and Pocono over the weekend? If you're drying out yet, give us a call and let us know. We'll open up the phone lines later. Time to green flag our Speedway Report victory lane lap and give you some results from this very wet weekend around the world and earlier this afternoon. The Sprint Cup cars finally got their race checkered flag last night, which originally was scheduled for Saturday night in Bristol, Tennessee. Kevin Harvick was your winner on the high banks ahead of Ricky Stenhouse Jr. in a great second-place finish. Denny Hamlin third, Austin Dillon fourth, and Chris Buescher with a great fifth-place finish after that Pocono win a few weeks ago. The Xfinity cars ran Friday night in Bristol, and Austin Dillon wound up being in the right place at the right time. Eric Jones accidentally spun his teammate Daniel Suarez and crashed out. Kyle Busch crossed over the nose of then-leader Brad Keselowski and crashed himself out. Kez then ran out of fuel under caution. Dillon took the lead on the final restart for the win. Justin Allgaier was second, Kyle Larson third, Elliott Sadler fourth, and Brendan Gaughan fifth. And since TV ignored them, Speedway Report will give credit to Jeremy Clements in sixth, Blake Koch in 8th, and Corey LaJoie in 10th. Dear NASCAR media, from me to you, these are the stories that fans want to see. I could not care less about any stupid chase. The trucks ran last Wednesday at Bristol. They were dodging raindrops all the way back then. Ben Kennedy led the final 20 laps for his first career win. This is the first time a member of the France family has won a National Touring Series event. How about that? Brett Moffitt was second, Daniel Hemric third, William Byron fourth, and Jay Sauter fifth. Now, battling Mother Nature last Wednesday night was NASCAR's Whelen Northern and Southern Modified Tours. They ran a combination race, and the tours partied like it was 2015. Why? The Bush's Beans 150 went green flag, then was red flag for rain. Then the finish postponed until after the Truck Series race because of Trucks Live Television. Then it was cut short from 150 to 100 laps due to the lateness of the hour. Eric Goodale held off Todd Zegarty for still the biggest win of his career. Donnie Leo was third, Patrick Eberling was fourth, and Doug Coby was fifth. Kyle Ebersole was ninth and credited with the Southern Tour win. The IndyCars were at Pocono over the weekend. As a matter of fact, just a few hours ago. They were rained out from Sunday and they raced earlier today. This afternoon, Will Power had the speed when it counted and won the Pocono 500. Pole sitter Michaela Lotion led 87 laps but came up short in second. Ryan Hunter-Reay had another car to beat as he started last, came up to the lead, had a late race electrical problem, and charged back through the field a second time for third. Great drive right there. Joseph Newgarden was fourth and Sebastian Bourdais was fifth. The NHRA was in Brainerd, Minnesota, and they did enjoy some good weather, thankfully, of all the top racing series that did not have to dodge all the rain. In Top Fuel, Brittany Force beat Antron Brown in the final round. Brown lost traction, and Force backfired. Then her chutes opened early. After all that, she still coasted to the win. In Funny Car, Dell Worsham beat Matt Hagen after Hagen smoked his tires. In Pro Stock, Drew Skillman outran Jason Lyne for the win in an actual competitive finish, 664 to 668. And in Pro Stock Motorcycle, possibly the race of the weekend, Andrew Hines defeated Jerry Savoy in a tight final round, 686 to 686. The difference? Hines had a perfect reaction time off the tree, 0.000. That is close. On the dirt tracks, the Lucas Oil Late Models had their Comp Cams Topless 100 rained out and canceled, no makeup date set. The World of Outlaw Sprint Cars raced last night in Prairie, Wisconsin. Donnie Schatz won his 18th A-Main of the year as he led Darren Pittman, Brad Sweet, David Gravel, and Logan Schuchart to the checkered flag. The ARCA Tour was at the Illinois State Fairgrounds in Springfield on the Dirt Mile. I love the Dirt Miles. Justin Haley was your winner ahead of A.J. Fike, Ryan Unzinger, Ken Schrader, and Chase Briscoe. The USAC Silver Crown Tour was also on the Dirt Miles Saturday night. They were rained out, however. Any possible rescheduled date is forthcoming as of our show date. As our show, our airtime, we did not have that information yet. The USAC Sprints did race in Brandon, South Dakota, where Chad Bay's plug won the non-championship points event. And on the short tracks, the Grandview Speedway in Pennsylvania, Brian Shuey won the late model main event. Paul Klein won the sportsman race. And in the headlines, small block modifieds, Craig Von Doren won his 100th feature at the Grandview Oval. Like I said, I was in Winston-Salem, North Carolina at the Bowman Gray Stadium where Brandon Ward won the Carolina Farm Credit 150 for modifieds. And our guest from 2 weeks ago, Burt Myers, finished fourth and clinched his seventh track championship at the Madhouse. And with that, let's step away for our first break of the evening with a golf reference. I'll put a pin in it. We're going to circle back around, and on the other side of the break, we're going to welcome Art Garner, the author of Black Noon, a fascinating story from Indianapolis. I'm looking forward to talking to this. This book has pretty much captured my attention for a couple of weeks now. I'm not finished with it, but I'm looking forward to it and talking with the author, Art Garner. Stick around. We'll be right back. You're listening to Speedway Report. I'm Patrick Reynolds. We will be back right after this. It's the Speedway Report now. This is how we rock.
Life insurance is one of those subjects that make people want to change the subject rather than admit they probably don't have enough. That's why we at Callie Wise State Farm focus on how the benefits of life insurance actually live on by asking people to think in terms of life without having to sell the house insurance or life without having to give up college insurance. Find out how the benefits of life insurance can live on for your family. Call me, State Farm agent Callie Wise, serving North and South Carolina at 843-272-9990 and put the life back into life insurance.
Dax City USA and Beach Music Scene Magazine are proud to welcome Ginger Jewelry to our family. Check them out on the inside front cover of the latest edition of Beach Music Scene Magazine or go to their website at www.gingerjewelry.net. That's Ginger, J-I-N-J-A, gingerjewelry.net. Check out this fantastic selection of handcrafted Balinese jewelry. That's Ginger Jewelry, gingerjewelry.net.
From the shores of Lake Norman in Race City, USA, Mooresville, North Carolina, I'm Patrick Reynolds. Thank you for joining us tonight. We welcome to Speedway Report right now, author of the book Black Noon, chronicling the story of the 1964 Indianapolis 500. Art Garner joins us. How are you tonight, Art?
I'm doing well, Patrick. Nice to be here.
Well, nice to have you on the show. I appreciate you taking a little bit of time for us tonight. This book really captured my attention right off the shelf that I found it in a bookstore. Let's start with a broad topic before we narrow it down a little bit. What made you decide to pick the 64 500 as a topic for a book?
Well, I kind of stumbled upon it. I was really became a race fan in 65, 66. I kind of knew some of the names, Eddie Sachs in particular, but I didn't really know much about him. And I just was doing a story on Fireball Roberts, of all people, and he was talking about Dave McDonald, and so I kind of followed a little research, and all of a sudden I was looking at the 64 race, which I knew really nothing about, and the more I read about it and the more I learned about it, the more I thought, you know, there's got to be a book on this. And there wasn't. Mm-hmm. And the story just really captured my image or, you know, interest, and that's what led me to write it. It took me about 5 or 6 years to do it, but it was a real learning process for me and a really historical process for me over racing.
Mm-hmm. I asked you that question myself, almost knowing the answer to it. As I looked at the, you know, the cover of the book, the back cover, and did a little research on the race myself, it was almost overflowing with various storylines that historically, and to the racing audience, the racing fan, gosh, they're just fascinating pieces. Some uplifting, some tragic, but there was no shortage of information and storylines for the 64 running of the 500.
And that's correct. You know, you've got the move to rear-engine cars. You've got the Ford engine coming into play. You've got the European drivers, Jimmy Clark arriving. There were just so many additional storylines to, of course, the accident and the stories mm-hmm. of Dave McDonald and Eddie Sachs fascinated me. So you're right. There were just one after another storylines. And when you look at those stories in retrospect, knowing what happens, you know, things that happen during the month are just the consequences are just amazing and just really captured my interest.
Right on the cover of the book, right under the title Black Noon, almost a subtitle, The Year They Stopped the Indy 500. We've seen the race over the years stopped before, but I wasn't aware that in 64, this was the first time the race was stopped because of a crash, because of an accident. That fascinated me.
It had been stopped once before because of rain, but never by an accident. And, you know, there had been 54 drivers killed at the Speedway up until then, and the race had never been stopped by an accident. So you realize how devastating it must have been for them to stop the race at this point. And obviously since then, when they stopped it several times since then, but up until then, it had never been stopped by an accident.
Let's talk about that accident. Your detail in the book is... Your research is impeccable, my friend. It's amazing. Can you describe this crash that, you know, almost step by step, what happened to who, and almost give us a replay and a commentary on this horrific crash?
Well, it was coming out of the fourth turn at Indianapolis, and the cars, and over the years, some myths have grown. And one of the myths was Dave McDonald was, had spun out in the fourth turn, but that hadn't happened. They're all out of the fourth turn on the straightaway, and McDonald was really running hard, running fast, and gaining quickly on Jim Herterbees and Walt Hanskin. McDonald started to pull out to pass those two just a fraction after Hanskin had started to pull out to pass Herterbees. So he had to dart out wider again, caught some air, and just the car spun at that point. He hit the inside wall, burst into flames, and went and shot back across the track and was hit by Eddie Sachs. Right behind Eddie Sachs were two young drivers in their second race, Johnny Rutherford and Bobby Unser, and another driver named Ronnie Duman. And so all five of those drivers are really a major part of this accident.
Yeah, young kids at the time, Unser and Rutherford, who went on to glory and a lot of fame at the Brickyard. But there was a, between them and some of the many names that we know now, Foyt, Andretti. When this took place, I think of them, you know, as the older grizzled veterans of the Speedway. These guys were all basically young kids at the time. They're going through this fireball with this crash at the start of the race.
That's one of the things that attracted me to the race. You know, here are names we all know now, Unser and Rutherford, but not at the time. You know, they were kids. They were starting at the back of the pack, and, Unser had crashed the year before, and he was driving in Novi, and, you know, he's coming down for the start and just saying, don't have a crash, don't have a crash, don't have a crash. And then, you know, to end up in that accident just a half a lap later, those are the kind of stories and coincidences that just drew me to it.
Mm-hmm. This was also one of the many historical points of the race, the final win for the front-engine Roadster. What was the attitude from your research in the garage and around the track as this battle was taking place between this rear-engine design and the front-engine cars that, you know, the old school guys wanted to hang on to, and the new people with new ideas, this rear engine car was coming for them?
You know, probably the two best known of the front engine drivers were A.J. Foyt and Parnell Jones. They both had rear engine cars that they tested during the month. Foyt had set a track record at Phoenix earlier in the year driving his rear engine car, but in the end, they both decided on the front engine cars, just for the durability and reliability, and, they were putting on a heck of a race, just the two of them, while the front engine, or the rear engine cars were out, you know, leading the race early on. And it turned out that towards the end, after about 50 laps into the race fairly early, Foyt had moved into the lead, and he was, you know, by himself. Nobody really challenged him the last three quarters of the race.
And this wound up being the second win for this young guy named A.J. Foyt at the time, the young guy at the time. Was the feeling at the Speedway that we were seeing the rise of a possible superstar or a legend in A.J. Foyt, or were people picking up on that attitude yet, that it was possibly just another fast kid that was here, another young hotshot?
I think he was well into the legend mode by that point. You know, the character of A.J. Foyt, the way he carries himself, the way he acts, people knew him to be, he was already in that legend mode. Even Parnell Jones, who had only been in the series a couple of races, who had won in 63 the year before, even Pernelli was, you know, in that legend mode. So while they were young, they were well-known at the Speedway, that's for sure.
Foyt wins the race in a front-engine roadster, yet that was the last one. What do you think was the turning point to the field just gradually going towards these rear-engine cars? What was the reason for that?
Well, I think that it was pretty apparent even in 63 when Jimmy Clark almost ran down Pernelli Jones that the rear-engine cars were the wave of the future. It was really a matter of how soon they would arrive and if there would be, you know, 1 year, 2 years, 3 years before the rear-engine cars would dominate. And, you know, especially with the combination of the rear-engine car and the Ford engine, the new Ford engine, those were tough to beat. They were lightweight. You know, in those years, there weren't any weight limits on the cars back going into 64. So that was a big help. You could run a lot lighter car. So it was just a matter of time, I think most people realize, until the rear-engine cars would dominate.
There was another change coming to the Speedway as well. Tell us about this, the swap over between gasoline and methanol. That was coming as well.
Well, really, up until that point, methanol had been used primarily, you know, over the years. And in 64, what happened was that Ford wanted to use just regular pump gasoline, high octane, but literally pump gasoline in the cars. They wanted to, in fact, they advertised that, you know, you didn't need exotic fuels in your Ford engine to race in Indianapolis. So they wanted to use the gasoline. But what they found out in the crash was, you know, gasoline is much more flammable than methanol and also burns much hotter. And so they had a hard time putting out the fires, the gasoline fires that started. And in the future, while they didn't outlaw gasoline, they took away the fuel economy advantages of it. So there was no real advantage to run gasoline. You had to make a certain number of pit stops. You could only use so much, only hold so much fuel in your car. So they didn't outlaw it, but they took away the advantages of running it.
So they basically made the rules so that it was really beneficial to run the methanol. They encouraged that and really gave gasoline almost a disadvantage just through the rules, and they could go in that direction for methanol.
That's exactly right.
What was the emotional toll at the end of this race after the death of Eddie Sachs and Dave McDonald?
Well, you know, Eddie Sachs was very well loved at the Speedway. He was a funny guy, you know, the clown prince of racing is what they called him. Very entertaining, loved to mingle, mix with the fans. So it was a very difficult loss, the loss of his life for many fans, because he was extremely well loved. And the way it happened with the large fire and the terrible fire. Dave McDonald was not well known, but I think as more people became to know him, who he was, you know, he's a relatively young father of two, had been a champion in sports cars, had really been on a roll since moving over to Carroll Shelby and the Corbett team the year before. So it really was an up and coming driver. So it was really, you know, a loss that affected many, many people. You know, one of the things since riding Black Noon, so many people have come up to me and talked about being at that race and what an impact it had on their life. You can just tell that the loss of those two drivers really impacted a lot of people.
How you wrote the book certainly impacted me. I'll admit right now I knew who Eddie Sachs was, but I confess I really didn't know much about Dave McDonald. And the more I read, you did an outstanding job in this book about describing Dave and painting the picture of him. I really felt connected to the man and really felt that racing suffered as big a loss with Sachs as they did in McDonald for this accident. So I'll tip my hat to you. Well written. You really painted a picture of more of an unknown in Dave McDonald, just as much as a superstar of Eddie Sachs was.
Yeah, I was very fortunate that Sherry McDonald, Dave's widow, agreed to talk to me about the race. She had never talked about it. She had never spoken with anybody about it, you know, since 1964. And, you know, I met with Dave's brother, his younger brother, Doug, And he talked to me a little bit about Sherry, and I talked to Rich McDonald, who was Dave and Sherry's son, and he eventually set up that I could sit down with his mom. And after a while, she just opened up and told me about Dave, and I think that follows through. That reaches into the book. It talks about his character and things like that that I could have never done without her assistance. She made it all possible.
Dave came from a different background than a lot of typical Indianapolis racers, which leads me to my next question. Dave comes from drag racing, then road racing, and on to the Indianapolis 500. At the time in 64, why did this race attract more European drivers, F1 drivers, sports car drivers, race car drivers from other mediums of motorsports came to the 500 back in that day? Why so much back then?
Well, part of it was the move to rear-engine cars. Because most of the Formula One drivers and your sports car drivers were used to driving rear-engine cars. And so I think there was a feeling amongst owners in that, hey, these rear-engine cars take somebody who has driven them. So that's why they brought some sports car drivers in and also Formula One drivers. The Formula One drivers were interested in coming to Indianapolis because of the paycheck. It was, you know, the money being paid to finish 33rd at Indianapolis was more money than Jim Clark won as world champion the entire season before. So the Formula One drivers were very much interested in those paychecks that were available at Indianapolis. And yeah, Dave McDonald came from drag racing. He moved into sports cars. He had driven for Ford at both Daytona and Riverside. You know, and Fireball Roberts had kind of taken him under his wing as far as the stock car racing went. So he was a driver, an up and coming driver in almost every mode of racing at that point.
Mm-hmm. And you told us earlier in the show it took you what, six years to write this book?
Yeah, 5 years to do to do the research and get it ready, and then one more year I kind of took early retirement so I could finish this book. I really felt that something needed to be done. So really just about 6 years altogether. I spent two summer vacations, I remember, at the Indianapolis libraries going through the papers day by day. It took a while to put together.
Mm-hmm. Now, you said you took early retirement. When you were writing the book, you were not a full-time writer. You had another job and wrote when you could, might understand the time frame.
Yeah, pretty much, early mornings, late nights, and weekends, and then during vacation time. So, and a lot of things were very interesting, and the research was very interesting. And then, really, when Sherry McDonald opened up and told me her story, that's when I realized, boy, this book needs to be written. And that's when I decided, well, you know, I was driving home from Sherry's house and thinking, well, one, this book has to be written, and two, I'm going to have to quit my job in order to get it done, and what's my wife going to say when I got home? But it all worked out. It was all very much worth it, and it was really enjoyed doing it.
Mm-hmm. That last statement about your wife kind of hits home to me a little bit, but I'll talk to you more about that off the air, my friend, if you don't mind. So you were not a full-time writer when you were researching the book. What did you do for a living while you were doing this research and putting this together?
I was in public relations, working for primarily Toyota at the time, kind of overseeing their PR activities. So I had a writing background. I was a journalism degree in college. I worked on a newspaper, the Marietta Daily Journal, outside Atlanta, Georgia, for a couple of years right out of college. And then went to work in the auto industry. So, I had a writing background. I had done a lot of writing earlier in my career. It seems like the more time you spend in PR, the less time you get to write. So I enjoyed trying to find something to write about, even if it was just for myself. And that's how I started on the project, and then it evolved into the actual book.
How did you research all of this? More in-person visits with people, or was it more phone calls? How did you do the legwork for this?
You know, it started out online. It moved into reading the newspapers at the Indianapolis Library. There were three different major newspapers in Indianapolis in 1964. all of them covered Indianapolis, or the Speedway. You know, every page seemed to have a story on the race or practice that day. So I really devoured those. And then, you know, there were six or seven drivers still alive. I had an opportunity to meet with each of those. And then, you know, talking to fans and others on the phone and crew members, trying to do just as many in person as you possibly can.
Mm-hmm. Now, you have an extensive list of people that you talk to for the book. You're obviously heard so many stories and quoted so many people. Can you give our audience, just off the top of your head, a list of the people that you did talk to, some Indianapolis folks, that Indianapolis racers that they would recognize?
Oh, sure. You know, like I say, all the living drivers include A.J. Foyt, Parnelli Jones, Bobby Unser. I had a chance, you know, to talk with Mario Andretti, who was, while he was not in the race, he was offered a chance to practice on one of the cars, a team car, to Dave McDonald, which was a very controversial type of lightweight rear-engine car. And Mario, at the last minute, decided he wasn't going to drive it. He wasn't going to test it. But I did get a chance to talk to Mario about that experience. A.J. Watson, who has since passed away, I had a chance to talk with him in his house a mile from the Speedway as he recalled the race. Johnny Rutherford, Dan Gurney, you know, just some of the greats of racing who are still alive. And I had a chance to talk to them. When I stopped the interview with A.J. Foyt, the PR person had said, well, I can get you 15 minutes. After that, it's up to A.J. How much time you talk to him. An hour and a half later, we were still chatting about it. you know, this had obviously had an impact on you know, many people, not just the fans and spectators, but many of the drivers who were there, too.
Well, if you got A.J. to talk for an hour and a half about it, you certainly, you know, hit a nerve, I guess, that he was eager to talk about this event with you for that long. That's something special.
Yeah, just sitting there, you know, and you're out of questions, but you don't want to, you know, you want to let AJ talk as long as he wants to talk for it.
Sure.
And, yeah, it was a special moment.
Mm-hmm. Similar question to recreating the crash in the book. You do it almost second by second, moment by moment. What was more beneficial to you for that, rereading the old archives in the press, or maybe talking to people and getting interviews and replaying it that way? What gave you more information?
You know, watching the video. There are several videos of the crash that are online, and, you know, you watch it frame by frame over and over. Really, it's difficult to watch. You know, I probably watched it 100 times, and it's still difficult to watch.
Yeah.
But that's probably the best part, because, you know, eyewitness accounts of what happened. You know, you got guys going 180 miles an hour, being right in the middle of it. The eyewitness accounts vary. With, you know, taking all that in and hearing those eyewitness accounts or reading them, and then watching the video, you have to keep an open mind on just what happened during the accident. And there are a lot of people who blamed Dave McDonald, who thought he was out of control, driving out of control, which I didn't think was the case. And I think if you look at the videos, most people will see that too.
Mm-hmm. Well, I purchased this book just a few weeks ago. It was at a Barnes & Noble in Huntersville, North Carolina. I was just cruising the sports section, and the title printing on the spine caught my eye. I took it off the shelf, and it's been kind of within arm's reach ever since. I'm not done with it yet, but I'm working my way through it. Where can our audience pick up a copy of Black Noon?
They're on. It's on Amazon. Barnes & Noble has most of their stores have copies of it. We also there's a Facebook page devoted to Black Noon as well. If people are interested in an autographed copy, just let me know and we'll send them off an autographed copy. But it's widely available. It came out in paper in hardcover 2 years ago, and then just recently in the paperback version. So there's a couple different versions out there.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a fascinating book. I'm still working my way through it. I love turning each page on this thing. It's a work of art, in my opinion. And right there, I got away with the checkered flags on this segment myself. I appreciate you giving your time for Speedway Report tonight and telling us about Black Noon. My compliments to you and what I've written so far. This well-written, well-researched, outstanding piece of racing history. Thank you so much. You have a great evening, and I thank you for coming on the show tonight.
Thanks much, Patrick. Really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you. Have a great evening.
Thank you.
Art Garner, everyone, author of Black Noon, the story of the 1964 Indianapolis 500. Time for another break. When we return, we will cover more of your Speedway Report headlines, and I will open up the phone lines for you if you'd like to talk. You are listening to Speedway Report. I am Patrick Reynolds, and we will be back right after this.
Bimini's Oyster Bar and Seafood Cafe has been serving nothing but the freshest shellfish and fish since 1985, beginning with the original location in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, and now including an inland location in Greenville, South Carolina. A local's favorite, Bimini's offers live entertainment in season in a year-round vacation atmosphere. Take a trip to the islands inland. Bimini's Oyster Bar, where there are no bad days. Check out the events calendar on the website at www.bimini'soysterbar.com or click the banner here on Shack City, USA.
A broken heart, I can't help you. Rocket science, don't know what to tell you.
Welcome back to Speedway Report from the shores of Lake Norman in Race City, USA, Mooresville, North Carolina. I'm Patrick Reynolds. Thank you for joining us tonight. Great to talk to Art Garner in the last segment, the Black Noon author. Multiple storylines in this 1964 Indianapolis 500 that he writes about. The rear engine cars to the last win for the Roadster, Foyt's second win, the passing of Eddie Sachs and Dave McDonald. So many things to talk about in this book, and fascinating read. Well-researched, well-written, good piece of literature for any race fan to have. Well, we'll give the phone lines a shot tonight if you'd like to call in. 843-272-1900. We have time to chat it up with you a little bit before we sign off tonight. One more time, 843-272-1900. Especially our tough race fans. Rain really played havoc last week in Bristol, Tennessee, as well as yesterday in Pocono, Pennsylvania. Bristol, I believe someone said that they had 19 straight days where it rained at some point during the day. Being the modified fan that I have, I was following the modified race online as well as the Truck Series race on television last Wednesday. I described that a little bit earlier in the show. They played havoc with the schedule last Wednesday as far as practice and qualifying. Modifieds got underway, had to stop because of rain. Then the start of the truck race came along. They needed that television window for live broadcast of the trucks. Then they finished the modifieds after the checkered flag fell on the trucks, all because of rain delays. And as you watch the truck race on TV as well, that had some rain delays and some caution in that as they tried to get all 200 laps in. But we all saw the mess in the rain on Saturday night, was not able to get the show in, almost got it restarted pretty late on Saturday night. Did not go, and eventually didn't 1 o'clock green flag on Sunday did not happen until close to 4:30 or 5 o'clock Sunday afternoon, with the Bristol night race on Saturday becoming the Bristol night race on Sunday, with the checkered flag finally flying last night. And I was not in front of the television Saturday, but I didn't miss a darn thing from Bristol. Where was I? I told you, the Bowman Gray Stadium, last race of the season for the Madhouse, as the speedway there is shut down until next spring. You may wonder why. It's August 20th. Was Saturday. Today's the 22nd. Why in the world is the speedway closing so early? Maybe some of you don't know this. The speedway is on the grounds of the Winston-Salem State University and goes around a football field. And on Labor Day weekend, they need that football field, well, to start playing college football games. So what they do is on Labor Day Saturday, those weekends are now reserved for football. And the weekend before Labor Day, which is this one coming up, is always reserved as a rain date for the championship. So their schedule ends 2 weeks before Labor Day. That's their final Saturday night. They leave that one extra week there for a rainout, so the championship does not get, you know, rained out if they can help it, and they run that extra week. But that's it. That's why, because they believe it or not, not everybody knows this, the Madhouse shares that facility as a joint football stadium. The infield of the Quarter Mile Speedway is actually a football field for Winston-Salem State University. Looking at some NHRA news, our pal here, Alexis DeJoria, missed another event with her fractured pelvis. She was absent from Brainerd, Minnesota. The NHRA Tour is coming up on a weekend off here before they head to Indianapolis for the U.S. Nationals over Labor Day weekend. That gives her an extra chance to rest up and hopefully heal. She smacked the wall pretty hard in Sonoma, California a few weeks ago, has been on the sidelines for a few weeks, missed Brainerd, Minnesota. They had the NHRA had a week off before that, if I'm going off of memory. They went to Sonoma, then they went to Seattle, then they had a week off, then they went to Brainerd, and they'll have another week off before they go to Indianapolis. So fingers crossed and good wishes to Alexis DeJoria for a healing couple of weeks. There's nothing you can really do for a pelvis except sit and spend some time and wait for it to heal. I give big tip of the hat to American Sportsnet for their ARCA coverage. I watched that yesterday from the Illinois State Fairgrounds, the Dirt Mile. I'm a big fan of the Dirt Mile racing, and the ARCA cars ran 100 miles on the oval there yesterday during the fair. And AmericanSports.net, free online coverage. I watched that race just like a television broadcast. Great coverage on Sunday afternoon, and it was perfect with the Pocono IndyCar race being rained out, the Bristol Sprint Cup race being rained out. So here we were with the ARCA cars. I was also watching the NHRA, too, on Fox Sports 1. So there was plenty out there for us, but I was able to fill my plate a little bit with that ARCA coverage on American Sportsnet. Coming up this Wednesday, August 24th, in Kokomo, Indiana. Little short track there, just north of Indianapolis, roughly an hour. They will have a celebration of Brian Clausen's life. There's a special race there this Wednesday night. So if you happen to be listening to us and are near the area at Kokomo, Indiana on Wednesday, great place for you to head on over. Before the races start on Wednesday night, they will celebrate Brian Clausen and all he meant to USAC short track racing and remember him at Kokomo, Indiana. Great story was that he ran the Indianapolis 500 this year, hopped on a helicopter out of the speedway up to Kokomo in Indiana on Sunday night, won the sprint car race there that night after running in the 500 earlier in the day. NASCAR has announced earlier this afternoon that in 2017, a fantastic move, 2017 Xfinity and Truck Series races will have free tickets to everyone 12 and under. This is a family sport. They promote it as a family sport. It's tough to take the family when you cannot afford it. The ticket prices have gone up. Wages have not. It's been tough for everybody in the last, well, long time anyway. But I think that's a great move on NASCAR's part. Under 12, you get free admission to the Truck Series and the Xfinity Series in 2017. We chronicled Ryan Hunter Ray's drive in Pocono today. Passed the field twice, came up a little bit short, but a fine car he had, fine drive he did. Finished third in the 500 today after literally passing the field twice. And gosh, I'm glad no one got hurt in that Pocono pit crash. Alexander Rossi, winner of the 500 at Indy earlier this year, was released from a pit stop, launched over the tire of Charlie Kimball, who was coming into this pit, with Rossi landing on top of Elio Castroneves. Luckily, no one was hurt. That put several cars out for the day. Scary moment on pit road this afternoon, earlier this afternoon on Monday at Pocono. Everyone in between our broadcasts, keep up on the world of auto racing with SpeedwayReport.com. We've got columns from Vicki Miller, Paul Bloffus, Steve Zonger, and myself. We also have podcasts of past Speedway Report episodes. They're right on the website. Check it out a little bit later tonight, maybe tomorrow. We'll have this one up as well. If you'd like to download it, check it out again and want to hear a little bit more about Black Noon and Art Garner. Jeff Gilder, thank you so much for the production work this evening. Appreciate it very much, my friend.
My pleasure, bud.
You can hear more from Jeff and the Racers Reunion family Tuesday night, tomorrow, 7 p.m. Eastern Time on Racing Through History. Right here on Racers Reunion Radio. We affectionately call it the Goat Rodeo. And don't forget that Free Pennington and Making an Impact kicks off tomorrow night at 6:30 Eastern Time. Thank you to Art Garner for joining us tonight. Black Noon is the title of the book. Head on over to Barnes & Noble or Amazon online. They can get a copy for you. Big thanks to everyone on the RacersReunion.com chat rooms for tuning in, both our stock car friends and our drag racing friends. I am thankful to be part of your Racers Reunion family. And as we get into the dog days of summer, your local tracks, well, aside from Bowman Gray, but your local tracks are still running. So get out there and support your local regional track wherever you are on the weekend. Drag strip, road course, paved or dirt oval, they are the foundation for the entire sport. And if you'd like to check out a rebroadcast of Speedway Report or any of the Racers Reunion programs, RacersReunionRadio.com loops the shows 24/7 throughout the next week. Like I said, you can download Speedway Report right on our website, but if you want to hear any programming of our live Monday and Tuesday shows, just click Listen Now on Racers Reunion Radio. I want to thank all of the military past and present for the freedoms we enjoy as Americans in our daily life, including the simple things like bench racing right here on a Monday night. Freedom is not free, and a veteran paid that bill for us. To all of the men and women who are defending freedom and listening to Racers Reunion Radio, take care of yourselves and come home soon. And a special salute to the teachers, school staff, firefighters, police officers, and paramedics in our own communities. They are quiet and modest heroes every single day. God bless and thank you. You have been listening to Speedway Report from the shores of Lake Norman in Race City, USA, Mooresville, North Carolina. Produced and broadcast by the Zeus Radio Network for Racers Reunion Radio. All of our NHRA and drag racing friends that appreciate great music, stay tuned right here for Bill Pratt, John Buckelman, and Barb Santucci on Racing and Rocking with DragList.com. A reminder to like our Facebook page, Speedway Report with Patrick Reynolds, and follow me on Twitter at SpeedwayPat. For Jeff Gilder, I'm Patrick Reynolds. We will be back in 1 week, and we'll talk about Sprint Cup in Michigan, Modifieds from Long Island, New York, the 43rd annual Oxford 250, and the finish of the Texas IndyCar race. Thank you all for listening. Good night.